This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, your 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century American History Guy. Thought November was never going to get here. I mean, 2 years of campaigning, debating, poll watching, horse racing, all that stuff. And after all of that, we're left with this odd phenomenon, the undecided voter. How can anybody be undecided, Ed?
Now, if you happen to be one of those undecided voters, really, don't take it personally. It's just that a historian is kind of confused by that concept because for a long time in American history, that would have been an oxymoron. To be a voter was to be decided. In the old days of colonial America, you made your choice and you stuck with it. Peter, you're our early America history expert. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right, Ed. Let's put ourselves in the picture. We're in Virginia. It's one of those elections for the House of Burgesses. And remember now, there weren't many elective offices in colonial Virginia. It was the big one. Who are the two guys going to be that we're going to send down to Williamsburg to represent our county? And I emphasize county because there's one place to vote. That's the county courthouse. Understand, courthouse is where you go to smoke, drink, and be rowdy. And elections are a public event. A little noise, please. Let's have some over-talking because it's loud here at the county courthouse.
I can't hear you, Peter.
Well, people have gathered around, and we got a couple of candidates in there standing up there.
Hear ye, hear ye.
Voters are going to come. They are going to publicly declare for whom they are voting in front of the entire rowdy crowd.
So everyone knows how you vote.
Yeah, they know where you stand. That's right, because you go up there and you declare who you're for, then the county clerk is going to say, so-and-so votes for so-and-so.
Mr. Ayers votes for Jefferson.
And then, very frequently, that candidate is going to step up and say, why, thank you for voting for me,
sir. Much obliged, sir.
And then perhaps there'd be some treating. You know what treating is, guys?
No.
It's when the candidates pass out the booze. In other words, you're not doing this kind of silent thing where you're going into some kind of penitential booth where you're you and your God and your candidate get together and decide who's going to win. No, you're out there in public. It's a very public thing, and it is loud.
Well, each week on Backstory, we rip a topic from the headlines, and we explore the history of that topic. This week, obviously, our topic is voting. How did Americans used to elect their leaders? What did the founders think democracy was all about? All those reforms we put in place, did they really improve things? And if things were actually improved, how come so few people are voting?
So now we've heard all about those elections back in Peter's era in the 18th century. Surely if we go into the modern 19th century, things would have improved after a century of practicing democracy. Maybe 100 years later, things would be better. But in fact, if we check in on Election Day in the 1880s and 1890s, we see that there's even more lying and cheating and stealing than there was back in Peter's time. It was a time, kind of like some other time you may have heard, when national elections hinged on the thinnest of margins and so could easily be swung one way or another by well-executed shenanigans. But whereas these days campaigns were all about personality, in the Gilded Age, it was all about the party.
You're not voting for William McKinley, you're voting for the grand old party, the GOP, the party that saved the Union, the party that will protect you from treason. Or you're voting for the party of liberty and personal choice, the Democratic Party, or the party of moral ideas on the one side and the party of personal liberty on the other.
That's Mark Summers, a historian at the University of Kentucky, who has written a lot about the hijinks in American politics, especially in the Gilded Age. And he's referring, of course, to the Republicans, what he calls the moral ideas guys, and the Democrats, the liberty lovers.
You can have Indiana governors shouting right openly there, every man that shot against you during the war was a Democrat. The man that killed Abraham Lincoln was a Democrat. Everyone who hunted slaves with bloodhounds was a Democrat. Soldiers, every scar you have upon your body was given to you by a Democrat.
And that's so-called waving the bloody shirt, right?
Well, yeah, but it's done on the southern side, too, you know, except you don't wave the bloody shirt in terms of, you know, treason. You wave it in terms of, if you don't vote the Democratic Party, you're going to have Negro rule. You want Negroes sitting in the school right next to your daughter? Do you want a Negro sheriff hailing you? And do you want Negroes on juries? That's what the Republicans are going to do. Vote the white man's ticket. Vote the white supremacy ticket. Let me ask you, if you knew that the issue was saving your country, wouldn't it be worth buying a few voters if the real issue was whether the country was going to be destroyed or not?
So the fact is that they really were unembarrassed about violating what an earlier generation, the founding generation, would have defined as purity at the polls.
Oh, the politicians were unembarrassed about it. As they would say, one of them wrote in a letter, sometimes you have to fight Satan with his own weapons.
So tell me about Satan's weapons, Mark. What were the techniques that they would use to trick their way into victory?
Oh, number one, you'd buy voters. That's a simple kind of thing. A voter costs you $2, maybe $2.50. Maybe if there's a lot of competition, as high as $10. Simple as that. The $2 bill, its main use is for vote buying. I mean, that's when it gets its big pullout. There's some people that might be Republicans, for example, who they would never vote anything but a Republican ticket. But if you don't buy them, they're not going to vote at all. And you're going to need their votes. And buying votes is really not all that hard to do, because in the days before the secret ballot, each party prints its own ballot, which means that what they do is the party organizer will put the ballot into your hand along with the money or along with the IOU or the promissory note. And when he sees you go into the polls and put that paper ballot in through the slot, he knows he's got his money's worth.
Now, sometimes, however, that straightforward approach of just buying an election doesn't work, and people have to resort to more imaginative means. What would some of those have looked like?
Yeah, colonization, for example, colonizing. Now, remember, up to the 1880s, states vote on different days. So you could vote in Pennsylvania in October and cross the border into New York and vote there in November. Simple enough. Or vote in Indiana in October and already have voted up in Maine and Vermont in September. That's an easy thing. So you don't have enough votes. A person who's smart can bring them across.
Now, all this sounds like these are acts of what we might think of today as corruption that actually involve the voters themselves in a very explicit way. But was there not backroom chicanery that was violating the wills of the voters?
Yeah. Boss Tweed of New York City, of Tammany Hall in the 1870s, when he was put on the witness stand once and asked about vote fraud, said it wasn't the voters that made the result. It was the counters that made the result. Let me give you an example of, say, Louisiana. Americans like to vote. In most elections, you can get a turnout, even a governor's election, of 70, 80, 90%. But in Louisiana, in a normal election year in the Gilded Age, you can get turnouts in some counties of 112 to 140%. Boy, do they like to vote. But you know the best thing about it? This is usually we'll get a turnout overwhelmingly Democratic with this 112, 140% in a parish that has nothing but black Republicans in it. Hmm. How did they do it? They did it because they put in the kind of votes and returns they wanted to put in.
Can we say that one party cheated more than another back in the Gilded Age?
Oh, golly. In Indiana, in Delaware, in New Hampshire, no. Each side will buy wherever it can buy votes. It's utterly unscrupulous, utterly dishonest. But you go on down in the South, and almost all the cheating, almost all the swindling is Democratic cheating. They're doing it quite deliberately because in states where there's a black majority, which means a Republican majority, or enough white and black votes to vote Republican, the only way you can win is by wholesale cheating, by owning the election officials, by intimidation, by threats. You dynamite their newspaper office before election day. You take out a few of their organizers and give them a flogging with barbed wire. You fish three or four black Republicans out of the bayou maybe a week before the Louisiana election. The other ones, they're going to get the message. They're not going to show up to vote. I mean, you go to Mississippi, you go to a black precinct. I mean, this happens in 1875. The blacks are getting ready to vote. A group of white armed riders with ropes over their arms come up and they say, when do the polls open? And they say, not for 5 minutes. And they say, then the shooting won't begin for 5 minutes and ride off. How many people do you think are going to show up to vote there?
Not many.
Not many, which is one reason why, say, in a county like Yazoo County, there's about 1,000 Republican voters in 1 year, and the next year, there's 7.
Hmm. Now, are there no disinterested reformers who are going to come in and say,
sure,
what did they propose as solutions to this problem?
Oh, they had a lot of good solutions. Number one is the Australian ballot. Secret ballot, which is what the Australian ballot is a ballot that we have today, one that's printed by the government that has all the parties on it, that they'll be handed, you know, at the polling place. Before that, what you have is a paper ballot. It may be, you know, about the size of a half sheet of notepaper. And on it, it lists one party's candidates. And that party passes that ballot out. I mean, Democrats, if they want to gull illiterate black voters in the South, you know what they do? They can print a ballot that has Lincoln's face on the top. Well, Lincoln's a Republican hero. Of course, blacks are going to vote that ballot. They can't read that all of the electors down there on that ticket are Democratic electors. Between 1888 and about 1892, about half the states in the country get the secret ballot. And then, sure, the guy can put a gold, you know, eagle coin into your hand for a buck or something like that. But he doesn't know he's going to get his money's worth, does he?
And so the result led into a golden age of American.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
The golden age of honesty that we're in today. Oh, no, no, no. If you have a secret ballot, it means that most people who are illiterate probably aren't going to be able to vote because they can't read the names. Hmm. One of the magic things about the secret ballot down South is that for a lot of Southern white politicians, this is the way to keep blacks from voting. Because if maybe 30, 40, 50% of blacks have not had schooling and are illiterate, they won't be able to figure out which party is which, and the Democrats will. It's meant deliberately to cut out the vote. But the other thing is, a lot of vote buyers actually are people of honesty, and they figure, if I've been paid money to vote for the Democratic ticket, by gum, I'm going to carry through. Vote buying went on in Kentucky all the way into this century and beyond. We've had politicians, prominent, up-and-coming good politicians, who were implicated and jailed for being an accomplice in this kind of vote buying. The secret ballot doesn't really cure it. Or I could pick a county in Indiana and show you the same kind of thing, or in Ohio and show you the same kind of thing. It didn't clean it up entirely.
Is there any part of the United States that's immune to this stuff, Mark?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. I don't think there's ever been an honest state in the Union. I don't really think so. When the advantage is big enough. I think most voters are honest. I think most politicians are honest, shocking as that may be to say. But there's always the people out there that want to give themselves an edge, and they'll get it if they can.
Mark, thank you so very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Mark Summers, who is a professor of history at the University of Kentucky. He's the author of Party Games, Getting, Keeping, and Using Power in Gilded Age Politics.
Elections are to make us laws for trade, peace, and protection. Who fails to vote forsakes the cause of fair and free elections.
This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow. We're talking today about the history of voting in America. Historian Mark Summers was talking about the introduction of the secret ballot in the 1880s, or as it was called at the time, the Australian ballot. But there's one thing that he didn't tell us. Why was it called the Australian ballot?
Fortunately, we have someone here on the line with us this very second who can answer that question. Caller, would you please identify yourself?
My name is Peter Brent.
And where are you calling us from today, Peter?
I'm in Canberra, Australia, the capital of Australia.
So, Peter, why is it called the Australian ballot?
It does involve kangaroos and things, but seriously, somebody thought of it in January 1856 in Melbourne, in Victoria. A guy called Henry Samuel Chapman is credited with coming up with the idea, but we don't know the actual details. This was when the Australian colonies were just achieving self-government, and they all decided to, rather than open voting, which was the way it was done in England, to have the secret ballot. And this was the way elections were conducted in many states in America and some European countries at the time.
So why do we call it the Australian ballot? Why do we give that away? I mean, we had some states using it.
Oh, come on. Brian, be generous.
because we invented the government-supplied ballot paper with the candidate's name on it. Those states in America and those European countries had a fairly casual sort of secret ballot where people would just bring along their own bits of paper. And the only difference between it and open voting was that you didn't write your own name on it.
Yeah, so you came up with the winning device.
That's right. Well, yes, it's the one that stuck anyway, I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing is that this was the way Australians thought at the time. You know, if something's desirable, well, the government's going to step in and take control and maybe boss people around and tell them this is for your own good. And that's different, of course, to ethos in America, which was more about keep governments off our back. And
Yeah, if we want votes, we'll buy them.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That is Peter Brent, a doctoral student at Australian National University in Canberra, Australia. And we're very grateful for you helping us out today, Peter.
This type of election employs the Australian ballot, which means you vote in secrecy on uniform ballots provided by public authority. When you have finished marking your ballot, fold it so that no one can see how you have voted. If there is an official seal...
We're going to go to the phones now. Some of you have already emailed us with your questions, and we've invited you to talk with us on the air. Peter, you have a caller queued up for us?
I do, Brian. It's Dan calling from Durham, North Carolina. Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, pretty good. How about with you?
Excellent. I was wondering, you know, through American history, what has voter turnout been like? I know that always ends up being a big deal in elections. I think right now it hovers somewhere around 50%, and it's kind of been on the decline. But I wondered, historically, what has voter turnout been like and what kind of factors have influenced it?
Well, I'm going to jump right in here because I speak for the time of the 19th century when voting turnout was at its all-time peak. So this is Ed, the 19th century guy.
Almost communistic levels from Eastern Europe.
That's because some of Ed's voters turned out more than once, as it turned out.
They rose from the grave sometimes. But we do have a sort of a paradox that in the 1880s and 1890s, in the time that, you know, fifth graders would have the hardest time naming the list of presidents in a row—
And not just fifth graders, Ed.
Yeah, well, I just didn't want to pick on them. But, you know, I thought maybe there weren't as many fifth graders listening to the show, and I wouldn't offend anybody else. But, you know, there's sort of an obscure time in American politics where it doesn't seem like anything happened. We weren't at war. You know, the issues we look back on now, what were the big deal, the tariff, whatever. And yet you were having over 90, 95% of people voting sometimes.
Hey, that's, the tariff is important. Come on.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, that was just a gratuitous swipe.
It was. I take the tariff very seriously.
So I take that all back.
Yeah, so Ed, why was it so much fun to vote back then?
It was often because it was like a big frat party. There was a lot of drinking. It was all guys. It was basically like making teams. And you'd have these contests, who can make the coolest flags and uniforms and, you know, all these different kinds of sort of public display.
Ed, if I could just add, also those teams were really evenly matched.
Yeah.
So turnout, you know, it's like a good football. People show up at a football game that they think is going to be close.
Yeah. And it's like they were giving away free items at every football game, too, that were really close.
Bobbleheads.
Exactly. But this time you were getting jobs, you know, or turkeys, you know, or hams or things like that. And then we think of the progressive era, right, which is all about direct democracy and direct election of senators and
good government.
Yeah. And what happens is it begins to kill off voting pretty precipitously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'd want to throw the ball to Brian to say, why the heck did the secret ballot and increased literacy and women's suffrage, why has it actually not helped voter turnout?
Well, Ed, let's take something like the kind of people who worked in government. Those machines produced lots of patronage jobs, lots of jobs that were handed out as a direct result of being connected with a political party. And that meant, you know, someone in your family might well get a job as a result of it. Well, that got replaced by civil service jobs where people took tests and were hired based on merit. So there was a much less of a direct connection between turning out to vote and getting a job. And here's one of the great ironies of American history. People didn't see the connections between voting and how it would change their lives, even as the national government especially started making all kinds of decisions that influenced people's lives much more, literally war and peace, if you count World War I, World War II, et cetera.
Right. Well, maybe this election will be different, right?
I think it will be, actually. If the game's going to be close, people want to see it.
Right. Well, thanks a lot.
All right.
Yeah.
Great question.
Thanks so much for calling.
Let's go to another call. Peter?
Next up, we have Keith from Northville, Michigan. Keith, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
We're excellent.
Good.
Yeah. I know your topic today is voting, which is sometimes included cheating. So here's my question. The white-only property owner voter was cheating in our view today in that a system denied other Americans their natural rights.
Mm-hmm.
But representation also included non-voters. How did the non-voters feel about this, say, in the 18th century? Were they insulted to the point of petition, or were they more inspired to become property owners if they were white?
Well, that's a terrific question. And the key term that you used is natural rights.
Right.
That is, we now know that we're just as good as everybody else. And we think of ourselves all as having rights. Now, what does that mean? It means that we're independent. We have a will of our own, and we should be able to express it. And no government is legitimate that doesn't build on the consent of people like us. Well, that's not true in the 18th century. And what you have to understand is that when Jefferson says all men are created equal, that's not the common sense of the thing. In fact, there are some who own and some who are owned, to use the most extreme case. But the large majority of the population, even if it's not enslaved or in some form of servitude, is dependent. That is, lacks an independent will and therefore a civic voice. Nobody on the outside, or very few people, I should say, would feel that there was anything unnatural or wrong about that. For instance, if you were a child, a wife, a mother, a member of a family, you would think that your husband, father, the householder, patriarch, he's the one who should represent the family in public life.
It was actually decades, really, before any kind of strong movement began to expand the franchise. So what caused it to change then? Why did we have to reinvent democracy if we'd only wrote the Constitution, 30 or 40 years earlier?
Yeah, I think you're getting right at it. The knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, it was this idea of equality. It had revolutionary implications. And you're saying, well, why did it take so long to have revolutionary implications? And I think the best answer, it's going to seem evasive to you, but the best answer is that the society itself has to change in fundamental ways so that a notion of the equality of all adults, including women, that's not something that would naturally be deduced from the kind of world that the revolutionaries lived in. They lived in a world of families. They lived in a world in which there weren't a lot of equals. You know, you could say that we had a kind of a deal. Take this notion of the independent property-holding householder who gets to vote. Well, the deal is everybody gets to be like an independent householder in the political realm. That's part of the deal. The rest of the deal is property is going to be protected, and which I think that's the short version of American history right there. But property and property rights, of course, are the basis of inequality in America and everywhere else. Right. So think about it. We got an equal and unequal society, and those two ideas are in constant tension.
But really what you're saying, Peter, is that they were in less tension originally when property was unequally divided and votes were unequally divided.
Yeah, and that was a stable synthesis that lasted for a long time in colonial America.
Now, this is a really crucial point, I think, because I'm a school teacher, and I think the way that a lot of the textbooks frame this time in history, a lot of it's on the emphasis of the freedoms. You know, you think about people dying for freedom is the way that's often portrayed in the Revolutionary War. And it sounds more like they were dying for maybe property rights. And a lot of it was based on the money and the taxation issue.
Oh, Keith, what a vulgar conclusion to reach. I didn't say that. People might die for family. What do you think about that? They might die for their community. I don't think these people are better or worse than we are. They live in a different world. But what I am saying is that the modern idea of equality, which we take for granted, was just not generally embraced at this period.
I guess the argument would be, wouldn't it, if we wanted to take the positive view, is that the founding documents created the context into which America grew.
Right.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for great question.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Listeners, we want to know what you think about all of this. When it comes to voting, how close have we come to achieving what the Founding Fathers set out to do?
Send us your thoughts. Our email address is backstory@virginia.edu, or you can do it the old-fashioned way. Our phone number is 888-257-8851.
We've got another call, guys. Leah from Princeton, New Jersey. Leah, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, thank you. I'm really interested in the 1965 Voting Rights Act, designed to protect the voting rights of American citizens, especially in the Deep South states where disenfranchisement was rampant and oftentimes violent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since then, Congress has fought pretty vigorously to extend some of these acts, with certain congressional members fighting just as vigorously against extending some of these acts. So my question is, to what extent did this Voting Rights Act actually improve the voting statistics for African Americans? Are laws or acts like this still needed, or are they remnants of the past?
Yeah, Leah, this is the 20th century guy, and so I'm going to take a stab at your terrific question.
Thank you. The
simple answer is the Voting Rights Act especially changed the voting scene in the United States, and especially the Deep South, dramatically. It didn't happen overnight, but it actually happened quite quickly. And certainly by the 1970s, blacks were registering and voting in proportions simply unheard of. And all you need to do is look at the number of African-American officials who are soon elected. Virtually every city and town, or most towns in the Deep South, now have either had an African-American mayor or an African-American who has competed for that position.
I'd agree that this has been an almost silent revolution in American political life that we seem to take for granted already. Think about why our southern states in play now for the first time since 1964 in the election of 2008 for the presidential election. Why is it that Obama is a credible candidate in Virginia? Because of black voters and all the work that's been done mobilizing them in the relatively few decades since the pivotal moments that you talk about.
Yeah, and I do not mean, I'm sure Ed does not mean to suggest, that those who wanted to maintain old ways didn't push back, and they pushed back really big time in the cleverest of ways. And that's where the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act really came in, because certainly throughout the 70s and even through the 80s, you had local districts doing all kinds of things to maintain white majorities. The most typical thing that they would do would be to annex a white part of the county right next to a city. This is what happened in Richmond when they annexed Chesterfield County. And often the Department of Justice, and also we got to give credit to the Supreme Court here, would step in and say, no, you know, this was done intentionally, not for reasons of city planning purposes, but it was done intentionally to dilute the value of black votes.
Well, this is one of the things that in my line of work I've been looking at extensively for the past couple of years.
What is your line of work?
I am finishing up a dissertation.
You call that work?
Yeah. I'm finishing up a dissertation in history that looks at black participation in the Republican Party over the 20th century.
Cool.
Oh. What percentage of black voters now are Republican?
In the last election, there was actually a pretty high, relatively high turnout of black voters. I think it was about 10%, which is...
So you don't really mean turnout, you mean percentage of the black vote that went to Republican.
Right. I think this election is interesting because right now the Joint Center is predicting that the Republican Party might get its lowest numbers since 1964.
Is that the Obama effect?
They're saying it's the Obama effect, but they're also saying it's you're not talking to me, we're not being included in the discussion effect.
Now, I want to point to something. One of the negative impacts of the Voting Rights Act, in many instances, we have created safe districts, districts that are absolutely going to elect an African-American representative. And in my opinion, as much as I support the Voting Rights Act, as important as it is, in my opinion, safe districts are bad for representation. Because whenever a representative knows he can count on a majority of votes, then he or she does not have to represent the true will of those people. They, in essence, get a free ride. And one of the real legitimate criticisms of the Voting Rights Act is it's contributed to creating too many safe districts.
Mm.
Yeah, what's the incumbency now? Is it 90% in most elections?
Well, actually, it's in Congress, Peter. It used to be that high in Congress.
But 2016,
it's really been dropping pretty dramatically. Yeah. And I have a feeling, given what's happening these days with the economy, it may drop even more precipitously in this next election.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Leah.
Bye-bye.
There were those who said this is an old injustice and there is no need to hurry. But 95 years have passed since the 15th Amendment gave all Negroes the right to vote. And the time for waiting is gone. This law covers many pages, but the heart of the act is plain. Wherever, by clear and objective standards, states and counties are using regulations or laws or tests to deny the right to vote, then they will be struck down. And under this act, if any county anywhere in this nation does not want federal intervention, it need only open its polling places to all of its people.
That was Lyndon Baines Johnson at the signing of the Voting Rights Act, August 6th, 1965.
Desegregation, mass participation.
We have to take another quick break. Remember, if you'd like to be a caller on an upcoming show, visit backstoryradio.org to see the topics that we're working on right now.
Coming up, we'll take on the most unpopular part of popular elections. That's the Electoral College. Don't go away.
You don't have to live next to me. Just give me my equality.